For the past 2 years, Myanmar has recorded the most deaths and injuries from landmines and explosive remnants of war of any country in the world. In 2024, reported casualties more than doubled from the previous year, in statistics that assuredly undercount the devastation caused by these terrible weapons. Although Myanmar had already seen decades of landmine contamination, since the 2021 coup and subsequent conflict, there's been a sharp increase in the deadly and indiscriminate use of anti-personnel mines, with children and other civilians suffering the consequences. People are being maimed and killed in the course of their daily lives, shattering families and disrupting livelihoods, with a persistent threat that could last generations. Insight Myanmar's in-depth series titled Navigating a Minefield explores the situation on the ground, impacts on survivors and communities, and humanitarian mine action making a difference at the local, national, and international levels. We are joining a network of independent news media publishing in Burmese, ethnic language, and English, both in Myanmar and in the diaspora, to raise awareness about the dangers of landmines and explosive remnants of war, as well as action that can save lives and support community leadership. More information about the series is available on the Insight Myanmar website under the Mine Action section. Joining us today is Kantka. She is a protection specialist working with youth-led humanitarian networks across Myanmar's central dry zone. In communities across Sagaing, Megwe, and Mandalay, she has been working on protection strategies for civilians living under constant threat of airstrikes, of displacement, of landmines. And her work includes explosive ordnance risk education, psychosocial support, and helping local communities build survival systems in areas where ordinary daily life has been reshaped by conflict. She joins us from direct field experience, working alongside communities navigating one of the most dangerous humanitarian environments in the country. So Kantka, I thank you so much for joining us on this episode. And before we get into the landmine crisis itself, can you help us understand the world that you're working in? I would like to ask you, what does your organization actually do in central Myanmar? And why did youth networks end up becoming part of the civilian survival infrastructure after the coup?
Hello, this is Kantka. Today, I'm participated in this interview to provide the real situation of Central Dry Zone in Myanmar. And thank you for providing this opportunity. Before we start our interview, let me explain about our organization experience and working environment for Central Dry Zone. Our organization is a dynamic and fast-growing youth organization founded in 2020. Our organization mission is to empower young people to build a society that is both peaceful and comprehensively developed, especially in Central Dry Zone. Our organization have committed to achieving this through our mission and collaborating with GMPP and new organization to empower and support them to become active agents of positive change in our dry zone community Anya. You can also call Anya for Central Dry Zone in Myanmar. Yes. We usually empower the community through sustainable program. We implement a humanitarian, multi-sector humanitarian aid program to respond the conflict affected area in Central Dry Zone, and also we do the youth empowerment program to enhancing our and promoting well-being through our humanitarian aid program. Yes. And also we, in our organization, protection is the main component of our project, our program and our intervention for Central Dry Zone.
Right, that's amazing work. And can you tell us, on a personal level, how did you come to this work yourself? Before the coup, were you already working in protection and humanitarian response? Or was this the situation of the environment of the coup that forced you into the role that you're now in?
Yes, before, I work as a practitioner for my professional work through defense NGOs and NGOs in Myanmar. Before the coup and after coup, I work as a practitioner in different areas of Myanmar.
And so then what changed for you emotionally once the conflict started to intensify in and throughout central Myanmar?
After coup, there have a lot of casualty in Central Dry Zone due to the military patrol or aircraft or due to the incidents on landmines and UASO. In the rural community, and this is a heartbreaking moment for our area.
And can you tell us, in this environment, why did the youth networks become so important in central Myanmar and Anya specifically?
Youth network, yes. Usually, youth are brave and to innovate it and to participate in every work, every humanitarian aid, humanitarian assistance action. And so we assume, our organization assume that youth are the key driver for community resilience in central Myanmar. Because our youth are not just hiding and sitting at home, they are a good leader to run the safety network and for their community. Yes, so that we base the youth platform to implement, to deliver our activities, to completely affected people, completely affected community.
And, for people that are outside Myanmar, sometimes we hear these terms, community protection or resilience. Can you tell us what those terms actually mean in practice for an ordinary village?
Yes. For example, in our rural area, I have seen one case where one of the farmers trying to clear mine and clear ideas and mines and themselves because they are desperate to plant crop in their lands, their fee area, but it's very danger for them for the community resilience. Community resilience actually look like in Enya regarding landmine. Those people do not just sit and living in fear. They actively attempt to survive through different ways, by themselves. Yeah.
And as we get deeper into understanding how the situation has changed there, and before we talk policy, I'd like to ask if you can describe one ordinary place in central Myanmar, ordinary before the coup, that no longer feels ordinary because of landmines, because of how landmines have come. Can you talk about a physical place that you have seen change as a result of this conflict and describe the way that it's changed?
Yes, and the community people from Enya didn't see any ID or any landmines, USO or some EAW before the coup. But after the coup, most of the community people, including children, saying that there are different ID, different USO, and different EAW in their nearby village or nearby village, because the military and militia use some factory made landmine, and they shell their aircraft bomb or artillery shelling to the village area. This is why the community people are familiar with these divides in their daily life after the coup. The situation is like that. Yeah.
And can you recall a moment for yourself or your team when you began to realize that landmines were no longer just an issue in the borderlands or ethnic areas as they've been for so long, but when it started to become a daily civilian issue in places like Magway or Mandalay or Sagaing, do you recall when that became or what brought that into an understanding that this was now an issue that was happening in village life in many places that had never seen them before?
Since the early year of coup situation, our team member and also our community people saw that there is landmine on USO in many places of their area. Yeah. I think since 2022, we have seen the many landmines, especially ID can see the near five village and factory made landmine and UX or some aware of urban area and also rural area.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of your work and your work at the organization that you're doing, it sits at this intersection of education, protection, coordination, and trust building, because you're not just delivering aid into communities, you're also helping those communities to know how to analyze danger, to organize themselves, and to develop survival strategies under constantly changing and very dangerous conditions. And so as a protection specialist, can you describe what does your role actually look like on the ground day to day at the village level?
Yes. As you mentioned, I'm not living in community, but my native is from the central drying zone. And also our team member are working and living in community. They always they always sing and working and talking with community people, and they always face their conflict related risk every day, almost every day, with their community people. So they can see and they can describe they can understand how the community prepare faced danger for every day. Yeah.
And then how do you help communities to be able to assess risk and develop protection plans around the threats that are coming to them in the form of military attacks or landmines that are hidden? How do you work with them for that?
Okay. Yes. As one part of the protection, our protection program, we conduct the risk education for our community people, and this include the risk of the landmines and UASO, and we educating the community people how we identify what are the landmines, what are the ID, and also we educating and the risk behavior to these device and safe behavior to this device, and also we support them to make their look at indicator when they saw and they face the mine or other dangerous devices in their area.
And in that work that you're doing, have you noticed or observed that there are patterns that you're seeing in the way that landmines are being used?
In our area, our community people can find the UASO. And UASO EAW from a threat of artillery sharing, and also IED used by local defense force, and they can see very easily in nearby their village and outside of their village or near when they are farms and free area. Mostly, the local defense force use these IED device to attack the military column patrolling their area, or militias patrolling in their area. Yeah, and for normal situation, and the IED are removing from the village area, and after that, when the local defense force receive their information about the military column movement or patrolling to the area, they reactive their ID device to attack militias and
And of course, the other side of risk education is when someone tragically steps on a landmine. And so, can you walk us through what happens in the first few hours when a villager steps on a landmine? Who carries them? How far away is care? How does your team respond? What happens in the immediate aftermath of a landmine being triggered?
Okay. If the villager face the landmine or UASO, and in risk education session, you do not step back and to safe area, you just very calm and wait there, wait to other for helping. Most of the people are facing, most of the people when they're facing and the landmine or ID or some danger item material, and they run away to survive themselves. It's maybe face the other ID or other landmine and explore and. Near their area. So, for your question, who can help them? Mostly, look at the defense force or village leader are have to save their casualties or casualty or injury people. After that, and they. Bring and they carry these people to their hospital or local hospital or local clinic, and then if we receive that kind of incident report, we try to reach them and have to reach them for their treatment, and mostly we provide their care support for casualty or injury people.
And of course, in the villages, those who come to step on the mines, they're indiscriminate. That is the nature of these landmines. And so tragically, they really pose a danger to children. And so can you describe what children in these villages, what they most often misunderstand about mines and unexploded ordnance?
Mostly, they aware that these devices and materials can and danger for them, but and they just bring to show other people or to save as a memorial item for their home, and children bring and play with this device. So this device are explore and danger for those kind of people. Yeah,
that's horrific. So you're saying that there have been cases of children finding and picking up landmines, bringing them home, thinking that they found some sort of toy.
Yeah,
That's just a horrific image that that is going on there. And as we go through some of the other groups that are affected and impacted by this, we know that there are real marginalized communities that are living throughout Myanmar that don't have equal access as others. So when you're doing protection planning and providing care and community decision-making, how do you make sure that marginalized voices are also included in that process?
Okay, in our activity, we always invite to the marginalized people, such as elderly or adolescent or other vulnerable group, from this marginalized group, so they can receive, they may receive our risk education or our safety, our safety message for their daily life. Yeah, we can always invite them.
And how about women and girls? What additional risks do they face in this environment, especially around displacement, insecurity, or gender-based violence?
Yes, especially in IDB. And they feel, girls and women feel their unsafe situation, unsafe living situation in forest area or their farm area when they display there. And also, there might be gender-based violence related issue, and violence are raised in rural area.
And, you know, one thing I think outside audiences sometimes might miss is just the sheer scale of what's happening throughout central Myanmar. Because we hear names like Sagaing or Magway, but it's easy not to grasp, especially for someone not from there, how vast these areas are and how dispersed the communities are. Also, how difficult it is to sustain humanitarian work in the middle of what's a very active conflict zone. And so your organization is operating across this huge stretch of territory in the dry zone under extremely dangerous conditions. I'm wondering if you can help us understand the scale and the size of the area you're working across and what it actually takes for this youth network that you're coordinating to maintain protection work over that very large area of geography.
As a youth-led organization, our senior staff, and our volunteer should prepare from this area. So these people are very willing to help our community, and very willing to help and support and their community prepare from dry zone. Yeah, this is the cliche of our organization.
Is that challenging to operate in such a large territory with so many different networks? I imagine that takes a lot of coordination.
Central dry zone have different authority, a different stakeholder to deal for humanitarian aid organization. As you know, the MEF restrict to their humanitarian aid organization. Our operation or our implementation team collaborate and coordination network with the coordination network with local stakeholder, local authority. But they have the different stakeholder and different authority in different area or central dry zone, especially in Mandalay region. In some area, we may coordinate with some local authority from MEF. For another area, we have a coordination and collaboration with local stakeholders from different sides.
And I imagine that none of this kind of work would be possible without trust, especially in communities that have been living for years under violence, surveillance, displacement, and fear. And I imagine that trust becomes even more complicated when you're asking people to discuss threats and to share sensitive information or participate in protection planning. So how do you actually build trust with communities in an environment like this?
We implement our humanitarian aid program since 2021 in Central Dry Zone. So community people from Central Dry Zone easily addressed for now. When they hear about these people, are from Gangkoye, and they already address us because they already receive our support. Also, we show our respect to them, and we show our image. We are not stand on one side. We only focus to support and to provide the assistance to vulnerable groups or provide the assistance to completely affected people. This is why and the community and leader are trust to Gangoye Blue Plan and Gangoye staff.
So it sounds like your organization has a local reputation of just by showing up with your logo or with your name, that communities are already trusting you and that you immediately begin a sort of collaborative process in learning about their local knowledge and understanding and bringing your background in community protection to seeing what solutions could work for them. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And I would imagine in this kind of environment that you're operating in, you likely have also been getting the attention of the military authorities who probably don't like very much what it is you're doing. So how have you managed to keep safe in the very critical work you're doing in this very dangerous environment?
We always work as a low profile in this area. And also our office and our staff are living in rural area, and we are not living in urban area. Our area have their MAF control area, so we base in rural area. As I already mentioned earlier, our staff living in community and living with harmony and in their community. And so, if one of the military call in or militia patrolling to their area, their village, and our staff running away to the safe area with other villagers, and also we built the safe place near our office to avoid the risks of aircraft and shelling. Yeah. Safe place meaning like a bomb shelter or something. Yeah.
Right. So you have to always be close to a bomb shelter to be able to run to if you hear the sound of enemy aircraft.
Yes.
And I think that's an important point because we've mentioned now that communities in central Myanmar, they're navigating multiple layers of danger simultaneously, not just the landmines and explosive remnants of war, but as you mentioned, also airstrikes and many others. There's artillery attacks, there's military patrols, displacement, there's the constant uncertainty of not knowing which areas are safe or maybe safe for some time, but then they're not. And so for the communities you work with, what are the biggest risks that people are trying to survive on a daily basis now?
Actually, the biggest risk is the aircraft. Because if the MAF used one aircraft to one place, it can be affect a lot of civilians' casualty during one incident.
And so then, when we're looking at these airstrikes, are there protection strategies that communities have developed, or like early warning systems, or bomb shelters, or jungle refugee areas, or other kinds of local survival methods?
Yes, the community developed their local ways to protect themselves. Yeah, there have two, three examples to explain them. And the first is the risk mapping. They identify, the community identify and the risk is path to run from their village when the military patrolling their area, and also they maintain the alert system like as Alimony system AWS. The community usually use the ground living tools because they, you know, high tech tools are not reliable to locate in your area because the mobile network and mobile network are shut off and rapid changes in the security situation. So the first one is the human network. The community, the AWS early warning system in communities that would be bad and trusted local network. They rely on dedicated people at the village level and township level who eyes and ears to monitor immediate threat. And then if there is a dedicated person from village or the township receive their information about the military colon movement, and they quickly deliver this message to the village via some kinds of mobile item. We call that ICOM. And the community also set up their sound signal to define specifics and coded sound using like a bass or loudspeakers or drums or whistle in their village. For example, a specific sound tells the community to activate their evacuation plan via their safe paths and move to pre-identified safe zone. If the bell or loudspeaker for two times, the community to activate their evacuation plan. For three times, and the immediately community needs to immediately move to the bomb shelter or designated safe places. Yes, this is the local early warning system in your area.
We're talking about these layers of conflict. And if we just go back to landmines for a moment, we had an earlier conversation with the landmine researcher, Yeshua Moser Pungshuan, and he said something that stayed with me. He talked about how when you're in a war zone, people develop different ways of coping because they can't live every hour with the thought that they might not survive the next one. And so then over time, the abnormal, it starts to feel normal, not because people accept it, but just because they have to keep functioning. And when you're talking about landmines that are laid indiscriminately in there, you know, one morning there's no landmines, next morning there are, you don't know how, you don't know where, airstrikes that are coming at any given place in time, and the digital surveillance that is also monitoring people. So really it's like, you know, every layer of human existence, the ground, the air, and the sky are all contaminated by this toxicity of military violence and fear. And so to be living in an environment like that for as long as Myanmar people have, and to continue not just resisting, but merely functioning, I'm wondering what kinds of things have you seen on the ground in villages that have become normal now in central Myanmar that would have been unimaginable before the coup?
Yes, for the community people from Central Rhinzo, they live adapted away in their daily life, and because their situation is very different since the COVID situation. For example, most of the community people from Central Drying Zone are farmers. Before the COVID, they can plant very freely and very safe in their field area. But after the COVID, the farmer are reluctant to go to their field area because their field area is suspected of contamination or GXO or something. So they always worry about their livelihood status for their families.
And how do you find that people are psychologically adapting to living with airstrikes, with landmines, with mass displacement, digital surveillance, and the possibility that what might have been a period of safety yesterday may not be safe today or tomorrow?
Yes, if we're talking with the community people, they always describe their feeling and they are worried about their situation, especially in their living condition and especially for their children education, because there are a lot of the military patrolling or the aircraft for education is not functioning in the area. So this is why they always describe and their feeling and their worry and their fear. But they attempt to survive their livelihood, to survive themselves and their family.
And when you see children or families that are still trying to adapt to this reality, are there things that still shock you when you're witnessing that?
They already showed their resilience. And to survive that kind of danger situation. During one of my field trips in the rural area, I met with the survivor of IED explosives and their family. The survivor is the father and the household leader of the family. After he lost one of his legs. And he can afford to find their income for his family. And his two children are not able to attend school. But his wife is trying to get the income for her family, and also the community-based school helps their family to their children to attend to enroll their school time and support them very well by their community themselves. And so, this situation, normally, this kind of situation, their family can feel down to survive themselves, but their resilience is very, how can I say, and their resilience is very high, tend to build up their community support is very important for those kind of family.
Yeah, I can certainly imagine. And I also would think that children now, even young children, they're probably learning to recognize things like the sound of aircraft or different artillery or uniforms or land signs that are indicating where landmines are or evacuation warnings for and when displacement is occurring. So are you finding that even young children are now being attuned and sensitized to all these different kind of markers and warnings of oncoming violence?
Yes, we teach them, young children, the sign, the local sign of there is material, like as the cross sign or different color stone are, if they found the different color stone in their near their area, you should apply it and you should take that kind of material. Yeah, we know we teach like that to the young children.
Are there worries you have, psychologically speaking, for this young generation that's growing up under these extremely difficult conditions that we've mentioned? And in addition, you know, lack of education, food insecurity, separation from parents, loss and death, and everything else that we've mentioned. Are you worried about how they're going to be psychologically carrying this trauma with them?
Yes. In some area, in some village, we support the safe space for young children, like as child friendly spaces to support and to support peer to support their and emotional well being and to reduce their psychological feeling. And also in some area, and the mothers and women in their village and self-recognized to create a more safe place so in their near their displacement site.
I want to go back to some of our conversation about landmines, because earlier on you referenced a little bit about your mine risk education, how it was delivered to the local level. You talked about your efforts to bring in marginalized groups and children and others. And so I'd like to spend a little more time on this and to ask you how you deliver mine risk education at the local level, whether through schools or village meetings, youth volunteers, community leaders, how, what the process looks like for being able to provide mine risk education.
Okay, for mine risk education, firstly, I have provided the risk education training to our staff. Then they deliver the key message to community people and using their poster or pamphlet and some storybook for children. And after 3 or 4 months, and our youth community volunteer can lead their can lead this kind of risk education session. Because we intend our intervention also intend to community led activities in for community ownership. This is not the short status of risk education and message delivery status. Yeah.
And then we know that in Myanmar, even though the military is obviously laying many of the landmines and being very aggressive and indiscriminate about how they're being laid, there are also resistant actors that are also putting landmines down as well. And so in addition to the education you're providing, does your organization engage in any kind of advocacy around landmines, explosive ordnance, or the protection of civilians?
Actually, we can advocate of the landmine. We just, as part of humanitarian migration, we can only provide the risk education and building support. We did not afford to provide, to do the advocacy to enforce us and improve. Yeah.
And another question I think your organization is not involved in, and this is demining landmine clearance or stockpile destruction. I think this is far outside of what your youth network of volunteers are able to do. But are you aware of any local demining or clearance efforts that are happening at local levels in the areas around where you work?
Actually, as I mentioned before, the local defense forces participated and leading in the demining process. They just, if they use the ID for, if they use the ID to attack a mere militia, they clear the ID device after they are attacking. And also, when an incident of aircraft or artillery shelling, and if their villagers or village leader inform them, one of the device are an exploded and situated near the villager home, villager houses, and they come and they try to bring away this device, because they just away the device, and they just bring away these devices because they have not enough mind clear devices or supported item.
Do you know how they're able to learn the process of safely clearing mines? This is an incredibly dangerous task that ideally only highly trained professionals should be able to do.
Yes, we know like that, and the highly trained person can remove the mine or time bomb, but the real situation is that these local defense people only clear the danger devices and material. Yeah. And so they also danger when the device is exploded. Yeah.
Has that happened before?
Yes. Since I think 2021, yeah.
You mean that resistance fighters have tried to clear or demine areas, but in the process of doing that, they've accidentally activated the mine and been injured or killed as a result, you're saying?
Yeah. They already face.
I'm sorry, that's very difficult. Have you personally seen the process of demining take place?
No.
Is it generally a skill that many different resistance fighters try to understand and to do, or are there one or two experts that teach themselves and then try to do this themselves?
Yes, few people can remove these devices, not for all people.
Great, I understand. I'm thinking about your youth networks as well and doing the work that you do, because I think that that for those not really closely following the conflict, there could be a feeling outside Myanmar, an assumption that the young people in conflict zones, that they're kind of these passive victims of war. But you've been consistently describing these new youth networks that you're supporting, something very different from that. These are young people that are organizers, that are first responders, that are messengers, and they're part of the survival structure that is holding these communities together and giving them strategies of how they can survive in extremely difficult conditions. And so when you're recruiting or training these young volunteers who are joining, how do you try to prepare them, not just with the skills and the techniques, but emotionally and psychologically to be able to do work on this level, which is, you know, I think, again, even for professionals coming from other countries, I think would be extremely difficult. So how are you working with and cultivating these youth volunteers who have no background in any of this?
Yes, for the youth volunteer, we always check their background via our local network. And also, youth from our community are very open and very willing to participate in our activity because I already mentioned before, and they are always willing to helping their community and assist to their community. So they are very interested to our activities, our implementation. Yeah.
And how are you, all this support and help that you're providing all of these communities and people across Myanmar, how are you able to maintain your own mental health through all of this hardship and trauma that you're facing?
For our organization, we have one staff who are working as the mental health and psychosocial support counselor. She provides their individual counseling to our frontline worker. And also, she can provide the counseling and psychosocial counseling session for our victim or our survivor, like as a GBV survivor or EU victim or some protection risk victim. Yeah. This is one of our supporting to our our youth staff and our youth volunteer and also for our community people. Yeah.
So I think just in the short time that we've been talking, you've described absolute devastation, the fallout from the airstrikes, the landmines, the trauma that people are facing, loss of livelihood, displacement, food insecurity, so many other things that make life very difficult and in trying to simply survive. And yet you've also described a kind of coming together, a solidarity, a resilience, a training, neighbor looking after neighbor, support being provided and volunteers. So we really have the best and worst of both worlds side by side. And you know, very tragically, very sadly, it looks like this is a situation which is not going to get better in the immediate future. And so I ask you, you know, when you look at the effort it takes to carry out the work that you're doing and you look at where the country is going, what you see in the future in Myanmar, are you optimistic?
Yes. Landmine will be a big problem in Anya area for many years. We cannot remove all mine yet, but we try to stay safe in our daily life. We always teaching and educating the community people to reduce the number of victims, your victims or landmine victims. And I hope that make every village in Anya as a safe zone through our community power.
And as you're speaking English now to a wide international audience, is there anything you'd like them to understand about what it is you're doing and what the situation being faced that we haven't talked about in detail yet? What message would you have for this this international community trying to understand what life is like on the ground now and what you would want them to know, as especially the stakeholders, as they were determining what to do and how to respond, many of whom have not really been at the village level where you're at? What would you want them to know?
I would like to describe as the situation of the landmine and the international or train the mining team can afford to clear and to assess in your area. Therefore, the survival of this community depends entirely on local response. And also, our Gengoye are working on the ground and living with the community repair, and we always open our hotline to support the urgent needs of within, and we always consider and try to clear the funding to scale up our pigeon system to expand emergency medical treatment or medical support. And also we always try our best to empower youth led safety environment in your area.
Great. You know, also after years of working this closely with these communities that are under such pressure, you've seen so many difficult things, fear, displacement, injury, loss at a very intimate level. And I'm curious, what do you think keeps communities going on even after all these years of violence and uncertainty? And where do people find dignity or hope or strength inside conditions like these?
Yes, it's very difficult to answer this question because the community people have themselves to survive their daily life, and also they are support each other to dignify their life, and they also support each other to live and survive for their family and their children. Actually, this woman is a great honor for me to speak on behalf of my Anya community, because you know, that bringing our ground reality situation to their world is crucial for the safety and protection of our community people. Yeah.
And it's really such an honor to have you on. You're bringing a voice of the reality on the ground that many of our listeners would be accessing for the first time. And so this is what our platform is built to do, is really to be able to bring this kind of dialogue, and you're the messenger helping to bring it. So we thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much, and for listening to the True Perspective from Anya situation. Yeah.
We've come to the conclusion of today's episode, and as the conversation you've just heard underscores, the humanitarian situation in Myanmar is dire and demands immediate attention. For millions of people,
the struggle for survival is an everyday reality, and the need for urgent humanitarian aid cannot be overstated. Through this platform, we aim to raise awareness and keep the focus on these critical issues. But awareness must lead to action, and this is the point where you can come in to make a real difference. By supporting the nonprofit mission of Better Burma, you'll be contributing to our wider effort to bring hope and relief to those who need it most. Your donation can go towards providing much-needed support to vulnerable communities across Myanmar and along the border that continue to be impacted by the military coup. Visit betterburma.org/donation to join this effort.
Oh, bah, yarananda, yarananga, 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 y